You're listening to the Fargo Podcast with Jeremiah and Mike.
Oh, yeah?
A podcast dedicated to the FX television show Fargo.
He says, is this what you want?
And that, sir, is the sound of opportunity knocking.
So put that ice scraper down and enjoy the show.
There you go, now you see it, the inescapable reality. You're trapped.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, to Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike. My name is Jeremiah.
My name is Mike.
Mike, how's it going today? Actually, this morning, we are doing this a little bit earlier than we normally do.
Yes, we are scarfing down a supreme amount of breakfast food between the two of us before doing this. Nobody knows exactly what we're going to be doing with said breakfast food after we record, but for right now, we are keeping it down, and we are hungry for more Fargo talk, especially after this episode.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, we're doing this a little differently, but it should go pretty well. Unfortunately, I am a little strapped for time, but we at least are making enough time to discuss this pretty solid episode, I feel like, of episode four here of season three. Mike, what was your overall feelings about this episode? Did you like it? What did you think?
I would say I still enjoyed it, but this might be my least favorite of the four so far. Again, I don't want to knock it too much. It just seems like, especially after that really fantastic and boundary-shattering episode last week with Gloria's trip to Hollywood.
Right.
I guess this is what Gloria Goes to Hollywood. Is that the 80s cover band that they're going to make after this Fargo season?
I
can't believe we didn't come up with that joke last week. I think that, you know, they sort of pressed the reset button a bit. We're moving things along. You know, I feel like we have accelerated the main storyline quite a bit, at least from Gloria's perspective. It seems like she kind of came back to Minnesota with a new purpose and, you know, something to really strive for. And with the help of maybe some guardian angels from the St. Cloud Metro, she's able to really make some headway on the case. And we got some Stussy developments as well, especially since we were really deprived of them last week. But I don't know. I just feel like after we went to such new territory and last week, to sort of have us return back home, both literally and figuratively, this episode was not, it was a little bit of, I don't want to say a letdown, but it felt a little bit of a step back from my perspective. What did you think?
Yeah, I understand exactly where you're coming from. Anytime you come off of an episode that we all feel was really special, it always makes the one afterwards, no matter whether it's good or not, it always makes it a little bit less is enjoyable because you're such on a high from the previous one. But I think if you dig deep into this episode, I think we did have some character growth, I felt like, especially VM Varga, which I thought was very exciting to see. And even with the Stussy brothers, I felt like we've had a little bit of growth there with them as well. So I think there's definitely some things here that's great. It is again setting us up, moving the narrative along with this, what is going to happen here, I think, down the road. So we're really setting ourselves up nicely. You know, we finally got Gloria at a moment where I think some of the confusion is really past her now, and I think she'll be able to really dig deep, and I think this is going to mean bad things for VM and the Stussy brothers. So it's going to really, of course, build into something extremely exciting as we are used to seeing towards the end of these amazing installments of Fargo. So it's a good episode, but yeah, I understand exactly where you're coming from. I felt that way as well, but it was still good television, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I was not disappointed. I maybe was disappointed in comparison to previous Fargo episodes we've seen, but again, almost like pizza, bad Fargo is still good TV at the end of the day. And I totally agree with your sentiments on Varga, who really isn't going to have his big moment in the sun until the last, like, 10 minutes of the episode. But still, it was absolutely electric. And I think we're finally starting to see, from his character perspective, we'll definitely get to it, but we're sort of starting to see his point of view and how he really is shaping up. He was sort of like this enigmatic character in the first couple of episodes who just sort of came in as a literal outsider in order to bring conflict into the main crux of the show. But now we're sort of starting to see his worldview, where exactly he's coming from, and how exactly he's going to manipulate these characters to get what he wants.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll definitely dig into some of that. And it just saves some time. We might yada yada a little or some of the things that are kind of minor and maybe kind of stick to the big moments here, because there is a lot to talk about, especially with Varga. I think we really want to dig kind of deep into that. Just sticking with the normal format, though, let's talk for just a few seconds about some of the creative choices that are always used, especially with this particular episode. But I do want to go ahead and mention some of the title meaning. I did look this up. So this is a scientific meaning, by the way. The narrow escape problem is a thing, by the way, in science.
So we're just done with bridge references at this point, it seems. Much like Nikki's bridge career might be done after... Ray missed out on that meeting with that key investor.
Now, don't give up on Nikki and Ray, the duo, yet, Mike, even though things may be grim when it comes to them getting a sponsor. But I think they're still going to play the amazing game of bridge. I feel like it's not over just yet, but we'll see. But yeah, I was thinking that too, because this is the second one that we've had that has no real ties into the game of bridge. This is another scientific term. It's an ubiquitous problem in biology, apparently. I am not a scientist, so reading this doesn't make a whole lot of sense necessarily to me, except for the idea of the formulation itself does kind of fit in nicely to where our characters are at this moment. So apparently this formulation is followed by where a brownian particle, or I would probably more have known as an ion molecule or a protein, is confined to a bounded domain, which would be the cell, a reflective boundary except for a small window, Mike, through which it can escape. Now, this narrow escape problem is that calculating the mean of escape time, the time diverge, where the window shrinks and has just this moment to get to escape, basically, which is great because that's kind of where we're, we're at here, especially with the Varga, with the Stussy brothers. I mean, there's a narrow escape moment here that they can maybe get out, and I think that window is going to close very, very quickly, and I think it's very interesting to see. So it was I think this is an interesting thing to look at is that moment where how can I escape out of this thing. I mean, there is these moments to close. Mike, any feelings on this meaning here for the narrow escape problem?
I mean, I feel like it even applies outside of the Stussy brothers. I mean, Cy is going to sort of reap what he sowed with his Hummer a couple of episodes ago. That's going to now lead the police on his trail, and you have that really ominous scene where Winnie is talking to him, and he's looking out at the two Varga henchmen in the lobby, and it's very clear that he's very nervous about it coming across to them, like he's squealing something to the cops. So it seems like really all of these characters are kind of having their respective windows closed in order to escape. I mean, Emmett's been trying to escape for the past four episodes.
Yeah,
and now, finally,
no kidding.
It seems like Varga has given him, in his opinion, the correct pitch to finally get him on his side, to sign him over as a partner. Ray now got fired from his job. I mean, Nikki is relatively unscathed for now. She seems like, she probably has the best opportunity to escape. We don't know too much about her convict past, but I'm assuming she might have more of a skill set to do that than maybe someone like Ray. But it seems like across the board from our more darker characters on that side of the spectrum rather than our lighter characters like Gloria, seems like the window is definitely closing for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%. And yeah, that's a great point about Cy, by the way, because I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about it. But yes, he's in a really interesting and tough predicament, which we knew was going to come to haunt him, because his decision, it was one thing to attack Ray because, you felt like Ray was going to let it go. But once he hit someone else's vehicle, he really screwed up there. And I know we got some feedback on this. His decision, to me, was really baffling. And I think it does kind of show that, maybe Cy isn't the brightest, crayon in the box, shall we say? But I don't want to bury the lead too much. Let's talk about this creative choice. I thought to tell this story by a male narrator that we all know very, very well here in the Fargo world, to the symphonic fairy tale of Peter and the Wolf. Mike, mm-hmm. Did you like this choice creatively as far as to set the theme here for this particular episode and really the season as well? I thought it was pretty clever. What did you think? Did you like it?
I liked it, but I wonder why do this in episode 4. You know, and yeah. let's be clear. I'm all for boundary pushing. I threw praises onto the show last week at the beginning of this podcast for really doing things different from both the one character focused episode, taking them outside of the Midwest, you know, putting the animated sequences in there. I'm glad that the show is taking risks like that. And also, you know, incorporating a male actor who played a character in the Fargoverse to do an overwhelming narration is not something completely new. Let's remember that in the very polarizing season 2, episode 9 of the Sioux Falls Massacre, Martin Freeman was the one who narrated that portion. So I think that's Noah Hawley just being Hawley. I thought it was an apt comparison. I mean, you know, as they go through the instruments, we have Emmett being the bird, we have Ray being the duck, Nikki being the cat, Sai is the bassoon, you have Varga's henchman being the blast from the hunter's shotguns, you have Varga being the wolf. So I can understand some of those character relations, and especially, you know, if you know the story of Peter and the Wolf, it might be providing some runway as to where things might go narratively speaking. But maybe this just felt a little too on the nose or on the snout for me, as it were, in that, like, I mean, you literally showed the characters as they were, and you have to wonder, considering that we know how the way the story plays out, do you expect things to play out exactly the same way as they do in the Peter and the Wolf narrative? Or do you think this is just sort of a loose allegorical structure in which to view these characters?
Yeah, I think it's going to be loose more than anything. I think for them, maybe creatively, they like the fact the story spends a lot of time about some conflict, of course, between the bird and the duck, which, of course, fits perfectly since we are talking about Emmett and Ray here in these respective settings here. And I like that. I mean, you know, a lot of people have been talking and lying about the fact that in the story, of course, spoiler alert for those of you who do not want to know what happens in Peter and the Wolf, but the duck is eaten by the wolf. And it's a dramatic scene, too, where they really take you as the wolf eats him and he's sitting in his stomach. So it's very interesting. I mean, the thing is, when you look at, I mean, to me, Mike, there's no surprise. If one of these Stussy brothers is going to die, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it makes a lot of sense.
Neither can live while the other survives. That's the prophecy that we put onto Fargo season 3. Yeah, I completely agree. I do wonder, not to, you know, ferment too much into these comparisons, since it only took place over the course of like 2 minutes in the beginning of this episode, but I mean, Sai as the grandfather is interesting, considering that, correct me if I'm wrong, but the grandfather was sort of just like the cautionary tale. He kept warning Peter, like, hey, don't go out there. There's a wolf out there. I don't really see how he relates to the Peter allegory in Gloria in that regard.
Exactly. Right.
And then, the hunters being Vargas, I can understand that they might literally be hunters. But again, right, in the story, I believe the hunters came into the clearing to kill the wolf, and Peter stopped them from killing him. I don't see a time in the future where Varga's men would turn on him. I might be completely wrong about that, and the story would really, you know, provide a narrative foreshadowing. But those might have been a little more of a shoehorn, but I do agree that, like, the bird and the duck and obviously the wolf and Peter are very, very on point.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly the way I feel. Like those particular ones do set up very nicely for the story, but the rest of them is kind of like, we'll just make him this, you know. it just to kind of fill things in a little bit. I mean, now I do think I think instrument wise, I do think those worked great for those characters. Like when you know, you hear some of these instruments, the clarinet come in for Nikki. I think it felt great. I think it felt right. But yes, I think as far as the story is concerned, I think you're right. They kind of took some liberties as far as some of the other characters. But yeah, the wolf, the duck, the bird, and the cat felt like the most dead on. And of course, and Peter too. But yeah, mm-hmm. Things like the grandfather and the blast of the shot, the hunter's shotguns. Okay, whatever, you know. But we'll see how this plays out, Mike, because I mean, you know, I don't think it would be no surprise, like I said, if of course Ray was to die by the hands of the wolf. It would not surprise me whatsoever. I mean, especially in this episode where we close, one of the last things we hear VM talking about was asking Emmett whether or not his brother and this woman Nikki was going to be trouble. So, you know, he VMs, of course, totally has Ray on his radar big time. And
emphasis on radar there.
Exactly. No pun intended, of course, Mike, obviously. But yeah.
It's not too early for you to make puns, Jeremiah.
No, not here. I mean, it's 6 a.m. here in the West Coast. So yeah, sure, why not? So it sounds like me and you are in the same boat. I'm okay with them doing this creatively. I think it was nice. It was fun. How much of it's really going to play a role here overall? Why do they do it in episode 4? Hard to say, but it was interesting. And I, anything they can do to kind of make things feel a little differently, so for every season, not feel like the same story over and over again. Which, you know, at times, even in this season, where it does kind of feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like it does feel a lot like season 1 to me. We've talked about this before, but you know, I'm okay with that. So now, can I mention one little fun fact that I heard, which is really interesting? That so as we were introduced to all of their characters from the narrator. By the way, we did mention the narrator is Billy Bob Thornton. By the way, who plays Lauren Mulvey?
Right, we should dance around it. Yeah.
I think we did just yada yada over that part, but yes. That is Billy Bob Thornton, the great Billy Bob Thornton, who plays Lauren Malva, which is a great, wonderful character from the first season. Not to spoil too much, but he was fantastic. His voice was very subdued, of course, during this, Mike. Did you recognize his voice right away, or did it take you a second?
I did not. This is also like my own like voice blindness, I suppose. This is something I always have a problem with, even like when watching cartoons. I have a tough time just picking out voices from hearing them. I didn't even recognize last season that Martin Freeman was the narrator for the second to last episode. I thought it was just some sort of chipper, prim British man. So I'm probably not the person to turn to in terms of recognizing voices.
Okay. Well, at first I knew I recognized the voice, but he had, like I said, he had it so subdued. I was having a hard time for a second. And after I was listening to it, I'm like, no, I think that's Billy Bob. And then, of course, as soon as I was finished and getting ready to do my research, I looked, and sure enough, I was right. But yeah, that was him. I did. So the little thing, so as the, like I said, as the characters were introduced, there was one little gem I found from a Minnesota writer that found this one. I did not really recognize it. I knew there was some significance about the model that we see Cy playing with. Can we say playing with? I don't want to say
it. I don't know exactly what he was doing. And I'm assuming you'll talk about the Easter egg, but I guess, is the model supposed to like represent, I don't know, like a parking lot structure? Or do you think Cy just enjoys playing with little miniature sets of the town?
It's hard to say what Cy enjoys. You know, maybe this is his thing. You know, like this is his away moment. You know, where he gets away from things, and I don't know. But I'm sure there's definitely some significance. So the Easter egg is the fact that apparently this is a replica of the street, the settings of the buildings where Lauren Malvo went to on his killing spree during the first season. So. That's the mm-hmm. Easter egg, but yes, that's a great question about Cy. Cy is a very interesting character. I love him a lot. He's a lot of fun. But I don't know for sure why this is his thing, but it is. It is.
Yeah,
it,
and speaking towards Easter eggs, since I know we're sort of segueing into this first scene, I don't know if you noticed, but we got call-outs to both seasons 1 and 2 in the bank scene, in that the chipper bank employee, who is of really no help to Ray's disguise as Emmett, recently came down from Bemidji, which is where mainly the action takes place in season 1. And when he goes into the vault itself and pulls out the bag of ashes, which is another Coen Brothers reference on its own, it wasn't in a coffee can, though, the bag said Laverne on it, which was the setting for season 2. So, again, I'm happy that they're not outright connecting things to the first 2 seasons as of yet, but I enjoy little Easter egg references here and there.
Yeah, me too as well. And so this idea that Ray and Nikki come up with, wow, this is a pretty intense for them to, you know, disguise himself as Emmett to come in and what they thought was going to be able to get into that safety deposit lockbox to get the stamp. But surprise on them, there was no stamp in there. The remains of a dog named after, like you said, a town from the first season. What do you think about what do you think about Ray? I was kind of impressed. I was impressed with Ray because, you know, when things would push come to shove, you know, he almost left that bank without getting into that box. But yet something kind of turned on him. And I think it had to do, of course, with what Nikki said to him, you know, right before he left, to say, hey, listen, the person with the most money owns the room. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion in this episode about money and the power that it brings and what you do with it and how you handle it. So I thought that it was a very fascinating. I didn't know if Ray had it in him, but he did, and he pulled it off, and he even was able to at least get 10 grand out of the deal, which Nikki, of course, seemed to be a little bit disappointed in. But Ray made a good point. Hey, listen, we're trying not to become – we're not trying to get away from being, you know, crooks here. We're just trying to get back what is owed to me. So yeah, what do you think? What do you feel about all this?
Frankly, I'm surprised that they haven't done this sooner. Not even just in the sense of this season, but just in life, considering that, I mean, even though Ray is the younger brother, they still look pretty much alike, especially when Ray shaves his facial hair. So, you know, I don't know where they got that wig from. Maybe it's a con that they frequently run. I'm not entirely sure what their relationship was like before the events of this season. But, yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I have a feeling we're going to see a lot more of it. You know, I'm a big fan of the television show Orphan Black, which is going on into its final season this summer, and they commonly do this. Orphan Black, not to go into too much about the show itself, is a show that deals with a series of clones that are all played by the same actress, and you commonly get the trope of the clones playing each other. I got a little bit of that sense here with Ray playing Emmett, but yeah, I agree. There was this one moment where Ray sort of like goes into Emmett mode and decides to kind of throw Emmett's weight around by saying, like, hey, you're going to drill into that lock right now. And I think it's a lot of fun because I think it shows that the two of them are really not that different in that if Ray has the propensity to be able to do that, I think that's not exactly acting as much as it is maybe him unlocking something that he's had inside of himself the entire time. Yeah. So I thought it was a really fun way to start things out. And now that the mustache is gone, I could see this happening at least a few more times. And like you said, this might end up with some unfortunate confusion for Ray that might end up with him probably in the wolf's stomach.
Exactly, yeah. I totally agree. I think that this growth from Ray could really be bad for him. We've talked about before about, you know, is this relationship with Nikki going to be his undoing? And I think so, because I think the innocent, naive, sweet Ray, as he starts to disappear, the more danger he's going to be in, and this is just not going to go well for him. But I enjoy the growth, and also this is going to set up some very just more interesting moments here between these two brothers as this kind of heats up. I mean, we see, of course, Emmett and Cy discussing this a little bit. I wasn't quite sure if Emmett was more upset about him just doing it at the act of it or what exactly, but it was fascinating to see the whole thing play out. So we jump in. I'm trying to, you know, kind of think. One of the things I wanted to say is early on we also see the introduction as far as the fact that VM apparently is living in his truck, by the way. Mike, very interesting moment. We've learned right off the bat that he has a bulimic issue, apparently, and we find out that he lives very modestly, so modestly he's actually living in his truck and spying on people. What do you think about this? Our boy VM, he loves living in trucks, apparently.
Yeah, and he's got you wrote in our notes here, he's got a spy shack going on for all Survivor fans out there. But he also is sort of like, I feel like he's if we're comparing him to Survivor contestant Tony Vlachos, not to spoil his game too much, he's much less frenetic than Tony is. I could see like the shark comparison, but he's less so chomping as much as he's sort of just like slinking through the oceans, trying to pick out which is the proper prey to strike at the proper time. But I mean, this goes to his conversation at the end where he talks about, you know, I wear $200 suits. I fly coach, not just because, you know, I can't afford otherwise, but because I really want to come across as someone that the quote unquote peasants can, the proletariats, if you will, can get along with, so that if and when the overthrow begins, I will not be caught in the fracas. I will be probably protected by my wealth. And there's also this really interesting voiceover that we hear from, oh God, now I forget the Russian guy's name.
Yuri, yes.
About, you know, Putin's life and the ideas of truth in Russia. He said there are initially two ideas of truth. There is man's truth and there is God's truth. But then he sort of brings in this third idea of
the untruth.
And a huge theme of Fargo is this idea of the capital T truth. Even from a storytelling perspective, you know, what is true, what's made up, it all depends on your perspective. And, you know, what Yuri is alluding to there, which essentially, like, it doesn't matter what type of truth it is. The truth is going to be whatever I say, no matter what type of the three it might be. I think it's very pertinent here in that VM is apparently espousing his idea of truth. But the question is, which one of those types of truth is he really giving to people like Emmett?
Right, exactly. And, you know, I heard some people discussing about, you know, what was the meaning of all this, the conversation. And to me, this is directly into this character VM, because the untruth, you know, he even mentions in there about, you know, the leader's choice is the untruth, because like you said, it's whatever the truth I say it is. And that is exactly how you got to feel about someone like VM, is that, you know, he's telling you his truth that he wants you to believe, and that is the truth. And it's very fascinating, because it also ties in great, of course, with the world climate. You know, I mean, we have all this talk, this Russian thematic theme with Russia involved in this season. And of course, you know, then you look at how things are going in real life, which is really interesting, because, you know, Russia's been a lot in the news, of course, as well. So, you know, Fargo does such a great job of tying a lot of things into reality to mix in great with, of course, the themes of this season. And I do like this idea about the fact, because that's how we feel a lot of times with especially people in powerful positions, is that, you know, they have their own truth, and that's what they believe in, that's what they want you to believe in. So it's very interesting between what really is true and what's not true, and I loved all of that. So that was great. Yeah. Let's talk about the introduction. Glory, of course, she does, by the way, get to see Maurice's body, which the production company did a great job. That was very fascinating to see the inside of his skull. That was great, I guess.
I didn't think I'd ever need to see a skull inside of a skull, and now I don't think I ever need to again. I've gotten that question that I didn't need answered, so thank you, Fargo.
Yeah. We find out that there's still, of course, this conflict between Gloria and, of course, in Chief Mo, and I did want to point out that there is a lot of people who are talking about the comparisons between, you know, this and season one with Molly and Bill. There is a lot of that. Kind of, it's a little bit too much on the nose for me, but I get it. You know, it sets up what's going on between these two characters. You know, I like this battle between the two of them. It's a little bit more, to me, it's a little bit more serious because of the fact that, you know, he basically did take her job. I mean, Molly wanted the chief position, right? But you know, with Gloria, she actually had the position, and this guy comes in and takes it in. So we get a lot more cynical character with Gloria, I think, than Molly. Molly was more subdued. She was like, oh, you know, I don't like this, but hey, I got to live with it. You know, Gloria pushes back with him. Yeah. I mean, she's like basically like, F you, basically. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
That's what I was about to say, is that, like, I think Gloria, and it's because she comes from a different position, right? She was the chief of her precinct, and essentially she's been downgraded. And so I think that's a different position than, like you said, with Molly, who was sort of like this up-and-coming deputy. And so Gloria is much more hardened. And, you know, I think, well, I can definitely understand the relationship structures are extremely similar. I feel like, exactly as you said, I think it's the difference are the characters themselves, in that, you know, Gloria just sitting there with Mo's like, you know, you're doing this, I don't like it. And she's like, great, I don't care that you don't like it. I'm going to keep doing it. Which I don't think Molly Salverson, as big of a character as she developed into, she would never treat Bill that way. I think she had,
no.
Even though Bill was a fuddy-duddy, I think she had too much respect for him in that regard. So I think there are shades that are different between this relationship. That being said, hopefully we see more of Mo than this one note. Hey, you know what? This is just like my army experience where men disobeyed me, and as a result, they got shipped home in body bags. It seems like from the preview we got showed him next week, might not be the case, but hopefully at some point down the line, maybe he'll have his own Bill moment where he has his sense of regret.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I've been wondering, too. How will we feel about him in the end? Is he going to be the a-hole all the way through, or is there going to be some kind of change? Something's going to happen to make us feel a little differently about him, so we should see. We'll see how that plays out, but I you know what? I have a feeling maybe... Yeah, I think I have a feeling that we're still going to not like this guy at the end. I don't know. Well, I could be wrong. We'll see. And I do want to briefly discuss about... Gloria, of course, has introduction with Winnie in the bathroom, which I thought was very interesting. Winnie shares a lot, Mike. She shares a lot in a very interesting way. her choice of words. We do get to see Gloria is still having trouble here with thing. I think it's sensors, Mike. It seems to me it's these sensors. None of them seem to recognize her whatsoever, and I still am at a loss as far as where exactly they're still going with this. Outside of some of the things that me and you have already discussed in this podcast, I don't know if you have more to add to that.
I know we got a question from Amanda Fallon about it, saying like, what could the payoff be with Gloria's war with sensory tech? She says, got to be something major since they're hitting on it every episode. I kind of disagree with Amanda here, just because I feel like Fargo has had instances in the past where they have made references to pretty crazy things that end up paying off with, I don't want to say nothing, but it ends up not really having major repercussions. The big thing that I think of off the top of my head is at the end of season two, when Kristen Milioti's character goes to her father Hank's house, finds papers with this weird alien language on it, and it turns out in the final scene of the last episode of season two, oh no, it wasn't anything strange. He was just coming up with a new language so everyone can communicate. And there are certainly thematic reverberations there, as there are here as well. I think we talked before about the implications that, you know, she's not being sensed by technology. She's not really being sensed by anybody else. No one is really believing in her outside of her son.
Right.
So I'm not personally going to say, like, well, this needs to be paid off by the end. I'm going to remain, like, cautiously, I guess, pessimistic in a way that I think it's just a bigger sign of the way Gloria has been treated throughout the course of the season. I would even bet on it being, like, if and when she does get her finger on the pulse of the case, then she's able to run her hands under the dryer in the bathroom. Like, if I could see them doing a payoff that's even that simple.
I totally agree with you, Mike. I think that's where we're going. I understand where Amanda's thinking is. Like, well, this has got to be something big. And maybe it will be. I don't know. We could be wrong. But I do kind of lean towards this mindset that you have, Mike, because I really feel that way. And I think that would be a nice touch, is that, you know, after she's finally been recognized, hey, you know what? I know what I'm doing here. I'm not an idiot. And then all of a sudden, you're right, that those sensors start working for. I think that she'll start being recognized. So I'm on your side on this, but, you know, Amanda, we'll see. Maybe there will be something to come of this that we were not expecting. And I would be okay with that. I'm totally okay with either way of you being right, Mike, or Amanda being right. Yeah. I'm okay with it as long as it's done right. You know what I mean?
Exactly. As long as it's done either way with a payoff. Oh, speaking of the bathroom scene, I mean, should we talk about Winnie Lopez? Because it seems like she might have seemed like a one-time character in the middle of this episode, but from when she returns at the end of the episode to provide pivotal information to Gloria, seems like she's going to become a much larger character throughout the rest of this season than Fargo. So how was Winnie Lopez's first impression for you?
Oh, I loved her. I thought, here's a fun, quirky character that we could get a lot of great lines from and really enjoy watching. So if the two of these, it looks like the two of these are going to pair up, a little Cagney and Lacey, a little female cop pairing, I think this would be a lot of fun. Because you could tell that Gloria is very annoyed by her. I don't think she's necessarily a big fan. Maybe she will grow on her, but I think this could be a lot of fun, the two of them finishing up here as we get ready to go into the second half of the season. I think this could be really good. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. No, I love Winnie Lopez.
Because I
think she's a great balance here. Initially, she is presented, as you said, as a really quirky character. Really has no filter with just talking with a random stranger about her husband's efforts to get her pregnant. And I love, you know, her entire monologue about how she feels like the sheepdog and the wolf in the Looney Tunes cartoon, and even she discloses her sexual positions of choice, which I personally would not do to someone that I just met. But then at the end of the episode,
what? Hold on, Mike. You don't, when you first meet someone, discuss about your favorite sexual positions?
It's like number like 4 or 5 on the list.
Okay.
But maybe I should be bumping it up considering how much I love Winnie here. But, you know, not to reveal too much about the end of the episode, but it shows that she is also capable of some good police work as well, which, you know, sort of goes against this idea that sometimes, like, Chief Mo characters on Fargo are sort of painted in a one dimensional light. She definitely grew three dimensional there. And,
right,
you know, Fargo also has a tendency to sometimes take random unknown actors and build parts around them. Alison Tolman's the biggest example with the aforementioned Molly Salverson. Here we get Olivia Sandoval, who had done a few things, but I think this is her first, like, big role, and I thought she really did a great job here. So I would love to see more Olivia-Gloria pairings for the rest of the season.
Me too, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because I didn't really think much about it, but if you think about it, right away we learned that Winnie has a very good sense of awareness, because she immediately noticed as she was leaving the parking lot the license plates. I mean, she immediately mm-hmm. knew that there was Gloria's car and was able to leave a note. So this is someone who is, when you first introduce, like you said, you think, okay, just quirky, dumb lady. And then you realize, oh, no, this girl's got some brains. She knows what she's talking about. She fits that perfect role of the Fargo police. Do we come up with a clever name for all of our wonderful Fargo female police leads? We have so many of them, of course. I don't know if do we. I can't remember if we've come up with something for this, but you know what I'm saying? She fits the role perfectly, and I think this is going to be a great pairing. I'm excited about it. I really am. Should we talk about one of the next big scenes that we have to mention? Of course, is the fact that we learned that Ray found out that you really should not bang the cattle. Because it could really come back to bite you in the arse.
I'm gonna miss Scotty. I'm presumably we're probably not gonna see Scotty again.
No,
been fired because I mean, what a lascivious man! And even I love his quote to Ray about like you can't use Nikki to you can't be using the harpoon tank to hoodwink and bamboozle. Just like such fantastic writing and using words like hoodwink, bamboozle, or even the word poontang is so. Eclectic. It was so much fun. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting to sort of see Ray's view from his relationship. I might have changed my tune a little bit. I saw that Mary Elizabeth Winstead did a live interview on Facebook on IndieWire yesterday talking about Fargo. And she said one of her first questions to Noah Hawley about Nikki Swango was, is she playing him? And Noah Hawley confirmed to her, and albeit then she confirmed to us that no, she's not playing him. She's just a very ambitious woman, and she is in love with Ray, which makes me happy because I feel like that complicates things a little bit more and makes her more of an interesting character. But it seems like now this theory that she is playing him mm-hmm. for a sap might be debunked a bit now, Jeremiah.
I like that, yeah, because I did write that in my notes. It's like, you know, is Ray just naive, or does she really love him? And I can understand the fact that you feel like maybe it's the case that she's been playing him, but I don't know, maybe she does really love him. I mean, I don't think she would even stay with him this long, right? I mean, through everything that's gone on, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there is definitely something there. I like this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, she talks about how she could see connections in the beginning between herself and Peggy Blomquist, the character Kirsten Dunst played in the previous season, but I think the key difference between the two is that Peggy had more of her head in the clouds. I mean, we sort of see it in the season 2 finale when she sort of has this like fantasy where, you know, her and Ed escape the freezer and they take out Hansi and they live happily ever after when it turns out that Ed just dies in the freezer. While Nikki is much more grounded. And so I can definitely see parsing out the difference between the two characters. And I agree with Mary Elizabeth Winstead. I think it makes things so much more interesting with instead of it just being like, oh yeah, femme fatale, she's playing her sap of a boyfriend, that she really does love him and looks out for him, but she's also so ambitious about what she wants to do with this bridge stuff that it complicates things.
Yeah, well, when you got a nutcracker caboose like she does, you know, I mean, you got to think... We're really gonna miss Scotty.
I know.
He really is obsessed with that nutcracker caboose, isn't he? You know what's funny is too. He seemed very proud of Ray. Like he was really impressed that Ray was hitting that.
Yeah, no, I think it's very clear that the only reason Ray got fired is because the deputy director had to step in. You know,
yeah,
I just
right.
showed the photos directly to Ray.
Who took those photos, by the way? Do we have an idea?
I don't know. I'm assuming that, I mean, the
state
celebration,
did?
I mean, well, Emmett had the big party, right? And that's where the photos
yeah.
would be. Maybe, maybe there was just like you know, I mean, you might have like a photographer for a wedding or another big event. Maybe they decided to hire one and they got those pictures. I don't think Cy was using it to sort of blackmail Ray in the future. By the way, best, funniest moment of the episode.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, Ray walks outside. Cy tries to come off all badass by doing like an evil monkey from Family Guy esque point towards Ray, being like, I'm watching you.
With the pointing.
But then he can't open the door to the Hummer. And I don't know if that was a botched take or if it was, and if they kept her, or if that was really supposed to happen. But again, just shows how Cy once again tries to be such a badass gangster, but he really pales in comparison, considering that he can't even, this poor Hummer is just cannot be affiliated with any of his activities from now on.
Exactly, yeah. I love that moment. That was great. I saw people saying we really need a gif of him with the pointing and then trying to open the door and can't get it open, because it was brilliant. It sets his character up so nicely. It continues this wonderful feud, this battle, whatever there is between these two, which I loved. You got to see poor Ray's beat up vet he put those locking wheels on his vet so he can't go anywhere. The whole thing was great. I really enjoyed that. And speaking of Sai, we get this moment. We already talked a little bit about this, but Sai, when getting questioned by Winnie, we had this question, of course, from who was it that asked us about this?
Brendan Fitzpatrick.
Oh, Brendan, the brilliant Brendan Fitzpatrick. One of us doesn't know, because he said that, we know Sai's not the brightest guy, but I mean, really, yeah, he could have done something much better in this situation. He really handled things poorly. I'm surprised. I just think he would do better under pressure than he has been. Is he just rattled so much by VM's men, you think?
I think that might be the case, personally. Though, again, I mean, we just saw in the previous scene that even when he attempts to be devious on his own, it doesn't end up paying off so well. So I think this is the guy.
Yeah, he's not good at this.
Yeah, he clearly thinks himself a Scarface, but, he's much more the viral video of the elementary school that did a Scarface play. And he's acting much more like an 8-year-old than he is a Tony Montana. But I think in this case, I think he felt extremely pressured by having Varga's men sitting outside, that he just wanted to end the conversation as quick as possible. And so he just sort of, instead of, as Brendan said, just sort of say, yeah, it was me, I'll pay for the damages, I apologize about that. Instead, he's stuttering and stammering and is deciding to, he denies the connection between Emmett and Ray as well, which I think definitely puts himself in hot water.
Yeah.
So I think that, even though we thought with the Peter and the Wolf analogy that the duck is going to get eaten, this is a case where grandfather might get eaten by the wolf as well, and that Varga might convince Emmett, now that he sort of has Emmett under his own wing, that, Sai's a little expendable. He's revealing too much to the cops. He's going to get us in trouble. He needs to go.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I mentioned before when we saw Sai hit the other car that I knew that this was going to be bad for him and probably be part of his undoing. But you know what I'm wondering, too, is we're going to talk a little bit about VM and Emmett's discussion and how that kind of leads to maybe their relationship being very different now. But I have this feeling that, with Sai being in having so much hot water here and having some issues, I know that VM only mentioned Ray and Nikki, but I kind of, you got to think that he has Sai on his radar. And if VM wants to have this relationship with Emmett and the two of them, going to business here together, what's the one person that I could see him wanting out of the way quickly? It's got to be Sai. I think we're going to see his demise very soon. Maybe not necessarily in the next episode, but in the next two episodes. I think by episode 7, we will no longer have Sai. That's my prediction at this moment. What do you think?
Yeah, lock that in. I think it's sort of this idea of, going to the Game of Thrones of it all, that Sai is sort of the hand of the king at this point.
Oh, yeah, good reference.
King of Minnesota. He has the king's ear, and he's going to really, especially in those first two episodes, he was the one that was really convincing Emmett, like, hey, don't make peace with Ray. He's clearly in the wrong. I'll take care of it. But I think Varga, I completely agree, is looking at him as sort of a competitor. It seems like Varga does certain things to competitors or people in his way, so much so that they get thrown out of parking structures. So, I think Sai is not necessarily long for this world, and he's not necessarily making things easy for himself by, making himself look extremely suspicious, not only to Varga, but also from the police perspective as well, which is why, I think he's one of the big reasons why Winnie and Gloria are now going to be chasing after his trail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. Oh, poor Sai. This is going to be so sad to see. I mean, poor guy, man. He tries, like you said, so hard to be the tough guy, but it just doesn't work out. It reminds me of myself, because if I tried to be a tough guy, this is probably what would happen. It would never go well.
I know you're a Mad Men fan. I mean, I think Sai is the Pete Campbell here, right?
Oh,
the
my God, yes. Yeah,
desperately tries to be the big boss, but it turns out that he really cannot measure up to others in terms of throwing their weight around.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we jump into this conversation with VM and Emmett at his house and the uninvited, unexpected guest that Emmett had, do you think there's going to be any implications about the fact that Ray, and I understand that, you know, his car was a little bit unusable at the moment, but his decision to just go and drink by himself and not make it to their big meeting with the sponsor guy, which was it Bert? What is his name? I already forgot.
I forgot the name.
Yeah, I should have wrote it down. But yeah, this was a big moment for Nikki. She's so excited about this, and he really ruins it for it. And we were talking about the relationship, but I have a feeling this is going to be a real love buster here for the relationship that he missed this meeting. What kind of complications can we see from this in the next episode? Assuming there's going to be some, right?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to assume that this is a little bit of a stumbling block in their relationship. I agree, because I think Bridge, again, is clearly Nikki's thing, and it's very clear that in doing this, you know, Ray is just sort of along for the ride. He is her functional partner in a way, but I think it's very clear that even though Ray was extremely sheepish in his firing, you know, him saying like, oh no, I'm in love with Nikki, and then you have Scotty saying, oh, you have 10 minutes to clear out your desk. He's like, oh yeah, okay, that's fine. I think it's clear, though, he's very emotionally affected by this. I mean, he just lost his job because of his relationship, and so I think he needs some time to stew and really think about things. I don't know if this is going to mean the end of the two of them, but I think it's definitely going to put a bit of a rift between them in that it might cause Ray to really think about the reason I got fired is because of this relationship, and she's wanting me to do all these things when I really don't want to.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Yeah, I totally agree with that. So we shall see how it plays out. Very interesting. I'm rooting for these two, you know, these two crazy lovebirds, you know. I really want to... I really want good things for them. I want them to get by. I wanted them to get out of this and live happily ever after, Mike. That's really what my heart desires.
No, that's Jeremiah. That's not happening. But good on you for being optimistic about them.
So let's talk about this, Mike. You're at home. It's dinner time, and look who shows up your door. It's Mr. VM Varga, man. Everyone's favorite bulimic gangster, whatever he is.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna talk about the bulimia for just a second.
Yeah, let's do that.
Bookended. We see it at the beginning and we see it at the end.
Right.
Do you have any extrapolation from this? Because, I mean, I don't want to offend any British listeners we have out there, but when I saw his teeth for the first time, I just sort of assumed, I wouldn't say it was the norm, but, like, you know, I don't think the British care that much about dental work, maybe as much as the American counterpart. But it turns out that, you know, one of the first things, at least I learned when being educated about eating disorders in school, was that, you know, with the actions of bulimia, obviously it wreaks havoc on your teeth, which is the reason why he does it. The only reasoning I could think in terms of putting this activity upon this character is that in Roman times, you know, they had the vomitoriums, and that was because the rich, the bourgeoisie of the Roman Empire, if you would, decided to flaunt their wealth by eating so much that they would then puke it back up.
Mm-hmm.
And there are connections to bulimia that are in a modern day culture that are totally outside of that. But from VM's perspective, I could sort of see that connection in that this is a guy who is going to talk a lot about how much wealth he has. And this would be kind of a way for him to kind of show it symbolic of everything, being like, hey, you know what? I'm such a gargantuan presence that I can eat all I want and then just throw it back up. Money is no matter to me. But outside of that, I could see it almost being a little random, right?
A little random. It's funny because when I was trying to feel what is the connection, what is the meaning with this, I kind of went there as well, because it really, this ties in perfectly with this conversation that he's talking about with Emmett about wealth, the importance of having a lot, but then be able to use that money to become invisible. So for him, he's indulging in a lot. He's indulging in a lot of food. You know, he has all this wealth, but he wants to hide it. So what, you know, when it comes to food, you get rid of it, and then no one knows that you had it. So I kind of tied in that reference with what he's talking about here when it comes to wealth, but able to be keeping it invisible. So that's kind of where I went. So I think it's kind of in this set where you talked about, you know, having eats until you eat, you know, so engulfs that you can't eat anymore, and then you throw it up. So I like this. I think that's really where the writers are going with this.
Yeah, I could totally imagine that. So I guess getting into the conversation itself, I mean, we sort of made mention of it the entire time, but, you know, I think Varga, he mentioned that he was a world traveler, I think, what, at the end of episode two. And so he closes the show out, or maybe not closes the show out, we get a glorious scene, but really makes probably the biggest climax of the episode with this whole speech about, like, situations around the world, it being the age of the refugee, again, hitting very close to home considering, I think, modern-day political goings-on that might be happening, and talking about how, you know, he feels like, especially in the wake of the financial crisis, that this is a day and age where there really is a disparity between the 1% and the rest of the world, and that he feels like the rest of the world is going to rise up eventually and overtake them. If and when they do, you need to be protected. So it's really interesting the pitch that he's making to Emmett, which is not essentially, you know, you can be rich beyond your wildest dreams. It's him saying, like, you need to do this because you need to protect yourself from mm-hmm. something that's coming, which is a completely different pitch than what I would imagine he would have given in the past.
Yeah, exactly. I like that how he says, you know, the people, the 1% or the rest of the percentage of the population, they're going to have their pitchforks out and they're going to come for you. And I did. I loved this. And you could tell because Emmett, what was interesting is we got the typical Emmett. You know, he's so annoyed by this guy. He just wants him to take his damn money and leave. And by the time they're done with their conversation, you could see him physically in his face, like really listening to him for a while and just started really buying in to what VM is selling him. You know, the VM's truth here, his logic, his two action points, right? You know, accumulation of wealth and then using that wealth to become invisible. And like you said, that protection there from the 99 percenters. You know, I love this. It was so great to watch this come through. And I feel like they're really telling us is that, you know, I think Emmett's on board. So much mm-hmm. so that by the end, when he's discussing his brother, he wouldn't admit it before to Sai, but this time to VM, he says, well, my brother's a loser. And that's a whole different side now, Tim. And granted, Ray has not... Ray has not been very kind, shall we say, to him. And he's really pushed his buttons here now with him stealing his money and his dog remains. But he is at the point now where he's saying, my brother's a loser. That's a big moment for Emmett, right?
I think Emmett's definitely the type of person who he'll sort of be swayed by the last person to talk to him. And especially if we're going with this idea of Sai slowly getting pushed out and VM taking his spot. Yeah, it does seem like Emmett's opinion is turning a little bit. We haven't had him officially sign the papers to make VM a partner, but we can make the assumption that it's gonna happen, right? After this pitch.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. I think this is gonna, everything's gonna turn around, I think, when it comes to this relationship. But it's gonna be just a matter of time, like I said, where it's just gonna be VM and Emmett running this thing. And this is gonna be very, very bad for Emmett, I think. If he survives all this, because I will be surprised. It's gonna, oof. But yeah, I think he's all in, shall we say?
Absolutely, and hopefully this also means that we'll finally find out exactly what VM wants to do with Emmett's business. You know, I feel like we've gone for the first four episodes, VM again just making this pitch of like, hey, let me do this. And they're literally behind closed doors. We see in this opening that Varga's men have like now built in some sort of like electric lock door that you need a car to get through to see what he's doing. Hopefully with Emmett on board, now we can see as the audience exactly what Varga might be up to in terms of utilizing the Stussy company.
Yeah, you're right. I think we're going to finally find out what's going on the other side of that door, which they made a big point to point out many times in this episode with the fact that they have this electric locked door behind there. And it, you know, that you really want to know what's going on in there. And I think we're going to finally, as we start diving into that second season, you're right, I think we're going to finally find out exactly what's going on with VM and his organization. So very exciting stuff to start unwinding here, I think. This is going to be great, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as we close out, we already talked a little bit about Gloria and Winnie's meeting. We hear the discussion. We had that part of the play with Peter and the Wolf where it talks about Peter not listening to the grandfather because Peter is afraid of the wolves. And then, of course, we do get to see the wolf, and, of course, we see Gloria, who's supposed to be Peter. Now, I don't necessarily agree with the fact that I think that and I say keep saying Peter, but Pete, whatever. Gloria, I don't really necessarily feel like that she's going to be afraid of the wolf, but I mean, there's definitely setting us up, as you mentioned before, about this thing between Gloria and the VM. I mean, it's really, we're finally going to start diving into this, and I think things are going to get real as far as her investigation now, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So Winnie sort of comes in, and again, as we talked about before, showing her own sort of investigatorial acumen, tells her, like, hey, I just happened to make these connections, and wouldn't you believe it that, you know, that these brothers are involved with, you know, the guy who got murdered by this guy Maurice. And we have this great sound to close out the episode of the tea kettle whistling, because it seems like after this revelation, these guys are going to be in a little bit of hot water. Gloria seems to start to really come around and be on their trail. Will she get clearance from Mo to do so? Probably not, but that's not going to stop her anytime soon for her and Winnie to really start going down this rabbit hole to investigate exactly what happened and what lies beneath the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it would be fun for our listeners to maybe come up with some cool, because I'm almost positive that this is going to be a twosome here, a female twosome. So maybe we could come up, if our listeners help us come up with something, a fun name that we could call this twosome, because I have a feeling we're going to see a lot more of it, and it's going to be good. I hope so. It's going to be great.
Yeah, well, Burgle and Lopez sounds like the name of like a TNT cable drama. But
ooh,
I'm
it
assuming
does.
There's some sort of like portmanteau that people could come up with.
Yeah. Well, I know you're really good at this stuff, so I know you could come up with, but if some of our listeners have suggestions, that would be great too. So, but yeah, this is going to be a great pairing, and I'm really excited about it. Mike, I have to ask you, did you go to VM Varga and get Rickrolled?
No. Okay, could you describe this a little more? Because again, after our conversation last week, I know what happened to older Blumpkin. I'm really hesitant to go onto this site without turning my ad blocker on.
Okay, well, I live dangerously, Mike. I went to VMvarga.com, and yes, as soon as you click on it, you're taken to that screen that we got to see the lawyer whose name is not coming to me at the moment, but and of course, yes, you're wondering, should I click on the link? I mean, it's scary. It was a scary moment, and what you see is even more terrifying, because basically what they turned it into is a classic Rickroll, where you are taken to the beloved Rick Astley video.
So, interesting.
Yeah, so that's what happens when you click on the link, everyone. Don't be afraid. Go for it, you know? I mean, Rick Astley is a treasure jewel of the music world, and I think that everyone should be Rickrolled at some point in their life. I mean, it's worth it. It's totally worth it. So, well, Mike, Go ahead.
I'm glad you resolved that for me. I just clicked on it now, and I did indeed get directed. So unless, you know, I get thrown out of any parking structures anytime soon, it seems like it's relatively harmless.
Yeah, I think we're going to be okay, everyone. You know, I think you're okay to click on it. You'll be fine. Mike, I really don't want any of us, though, to be thrown off of a parking structure. That would it really doesn't go well for your day, you know?
Absolutely.
I've got plans for the day, and I really prefer them to stay grounded. You know what I mean?
Well, you're about to fly soon, so hopefully it won't stay completely grounded.
That's actually a good point. I will be spending quite a few hours in the air. Ooh, yeah, you don't want to get thrown out of an airplane either. That would be bad.
Yeah.
Well, luckily, we don't have to worry about updating our death draft. No one died in this episode. Mm-hmm. Kind of disappointing a little bit, but that's okay. do we miss any questions? I know that Amanda, speaking of computers and hacking and things, but I do know Amanda also mentioned about whether or not we should all delete our social media accounts to keep the wolves away. And it's funny, because I was going to mention, you know, when I saw VM, we see the scene of him doing his investigation on Ray and Emmett, you know, because, you know, VM knows everything about these guys. And I flashed to Mr. Robot. It's what I thought. I thought myself, oh, VM is Mr. Robot. He's a hacker. He, you know, that's what I thought about. But this is a good point, because me and my wife actually have been having this conversation about how much of our personal information is online and so easily obtained that it is kind of scary if you think about it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, again, we talked about this last week about how we feel like this area, this location is sort of almost within its own bubble in terms of technology, and I think naivete that they probably think, like, oh yeah, if I'm on the phone with somebody, and even though Sci tries to take caution of, like, hey, I shouldn't be talking about this over the phone, it's clear that his conversation is still overheard as it is. And I think, again, Varga just coming in as this outsider really shows that this location is set in a place out of time, and that, you know, mm-hmm. they're really looking at the rest of the world with sort of a bright-eyed optimism, when it turns out that the real world, or at least the real world from the show's perspective, is much darker than they realize and can very easily take advantage of them.
Yeah, absolutely. So, great stuff, Mike. This was fun. I really enjoyed breaking it down here at in the wee hours here on the West Coast. Not so wee hours necessarily where you were at on the East Coast, but hey, we made it through. We survived. We got through a wonderful podcast. I mean, I think it's wonderful. I mean, you know, I think we are amazing, of course, as usual, but no. Well, we did it.
Fantastic job, as always. Again, given the circumstances, as we said, Jeremiah, you were recording, you know, 6 to 7 in the morning. Thank you to all the listeners out there for checking this out. If you want to let us know your thoughts on the episode, you can reach out to us on Twitter. Jeremiah is at J Panhorst. I am at a Mike Bloom type. If you want to send us feedback, I haven't been plugging this, I've completely forgotten. And for the next episode, you can email us fargowithmj@gmail.com. fargowithmj@gmail.com. If you have any sort of long-term thoughts that we can read out on the podcast, or tweets, as we talked about in this podcast, make sure you're subscribed to Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike as well on iTunes. And while you're there, please leave us any ratings and reviews possible. We greatly appreciate the feedback, and we are so grateful for people who have left us feedback so far. So thank you so much about that. And also check out all the other great stuff on the Jane Jack Network as well. I know I was just in the big North Carolina celebration the past weekend, which was a lot of fun. Got to do a live leftover show there. My wife was actually just on the past episode of the broadcast, which should be coming out soon. We have The Married Man, we have Survivor, a Star Wars podcast just started up. So yeah, lots of stuff going on the Jay and Jack Network. If you want to make sure you're tuned into that, subscribe to the Jay and Jack whole enchilada feed, which should include this podcast as well. And if you want to become a patron, there are so many exclusive things you can do on there. I don't even want to list them out, so be sure to check that out as well. But yeah, this was a really it might not be my favorite episode of Fargo so far, but I love getting to talk about it with you, Jeremiah. And as you said, there seemed to be some loose threads that were really interesting to investigate, and I look forward to seeing exactly where things are going to go in episode 5.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. I think we're on the right track. We're heading down a path that I think is going to be a lot of fun for me and you to talk about. So it's going to be great, my friend. So until next week, we will get together again, all right?
Sounds good.
All right, everybody. Take care.